Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we have a new horror film to review. We dive back into Matt Reeves' Batman universe with the Penguin, and director Josh Cooley joins us to discuss his awesome new animated movie, Transformers 1.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 322 of Real Blend, a podcast that promises to be more than meets the eye. On this week's show, we have a new horror movie to review called The Substance.
Yeah, we do.
Starring Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley, getting a lot of buzz. We're diving back into Matt Reeves' Batman franchise because The Penguin is going to be on HBO Max currently.
Yeah, it is.
By the time you guys are listening to this, episode number one is available to you. And director Josh Cooley is going to join us to discuss his awesome new film, Transformers 1. It's an animated movie. Arguably, I think, should have been the first movie in the Transformers franchise ever because of the way it sets up the mythology.
Michael Bay would have some words to say about that.
Well, I'm not shitting on Bay. I'm just saying this is a really good intro to the franchise. We'll get into that in a minute. I want to join. Look at the angelically dressed Kevin McCarthy and Jake Hamilton wearing their shades of white. And I am in my dark, somber looking office, my black shirt. Hello, boys. How are you? Good to see you.
Well, if you could see, I don't know how your rectangles are lined up, but Kevin and I are on one side of my screen and you and Gabe are on the other. And both of your shots are a bit on the darker side. And then Kevin and I, sweet, sweet angels, are a little bit
precious.
Jake is glowing for some reason.
I don't know why. It's actually a beautiful day in Chicago, it looks like.
Yes, it is.
It's very rainy and somber, and it's the mood of Panthers fans everywhere. Essentially, they're reflective of the NFL.
Well, this is not the mood of. I mean, it might be the mood of me and being a Texans fan, but this is not the mood of Bears fans right now.
Let's do a check in on your fantasy team since we all live vicariously through your fantasy. How are you 2-0 on the season?
Well, it depends on how well Jalen Hurts does today. I've got a 24-point lead on the guy I'm playing, and he has Jalen Hurts tonight, so it could be. Could be close.
Are you regretting the McCaffrey pick at number one? Hello, Jake. You still there? Jake might have froze. Jake,
listen. Jacob? We don't talk about personal stuff like that.
You don't say that name. Right? Do you not speak that name?
Listen. His handcuff is doing very well.
Why don't you remind the people who told you not to draft Christian McCaffrey in the first?
The same guy who told me that Lord of the Rings is not good.
Dr. Sean O'Connell told you.
Hey.
He knew that leg wasn't coming back.
Yeah. Kev, how's Dan Marino doing?
Nothing bad ever happened to the guy on the cover of Madden.
True. Dan Marino is crushing it in my fantasy league this year.
But the only stat is has appeared in Ace Ventura movies.
Right.
Kevin wins every week.
I actually drafted the dolphin from Ace Ventura, and I am the number one in my league.
Snowflake?
Amazing. Yeah, Snowflake. I'm crushing it.
Once again, the stat is has appeared in Ace Ventura movies.
Now I need to
laces out, everybody.
The laces were in.
Laces out.
Ace Ventura might be the best movie to have a member of the cast of Friends in it.
Wait, Courtney Cox.
Courtney Cox is in it.
Wait, you're discounting Scream.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Yes. Come on, okay. Yeah.
Thought I had something for a second there.
Yeah.
No, it's so funny because I was like, and I wasn't actively trying to dispute it, but I was like, that's an interesting.
Oh, Aniston's been in some good movies as well too. Aniston's but like,
Aniston.
I don't know if I'm putting him above Ace.
Who?
Jennifer Aniston.
Scream is better than Ace Ventura.
Scream is better than Ace Ventura. Yes, I will give it that.
It's not better than Ace Ventura, but 17 Again is a good movie.
I love 17 Again.
Yeah.
It's not better than Ace Ventura.
Not
better than Ace. Where's all the disrespect here for Along Came Polly? Like, what is going on this podcast?
Oh, yeah. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. See?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry, but Ace Ventura is a better
movie. What was the Swiss Family Robinson in Space movie that Matt LeBlanc did?
Lost in Space.
I loved that movie growing up. I watched that religiously. Joey was a badass action star.
But arguably, like, I think The Breakup is a legitimately good movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chicago.
Jennifer Aniston and Vince Vaughn.
It's another good one.
Yeah.
Also, another great Jennifer Aniston comedy, We're the Millers.
Oh, I love We're the Millers.
We're the Millers is good. Funny.
we're just going to go through the filmography.
Horrible Bosses is good. Horrible Bosses is funny.
And the guy who played Phoebe's husband has been in some movies.
How far out of the cast are we going? Are we going to go with Elliot?
How about friend star Brad Pitt?
I was just about to say Elliot Gould. Yeah. Can we say Elliot Gould?
How about Bruce Willis? Hey.
Something I've always wanted to ask the cast, like... So in Friends, Chandler and Ross and Joey are famously obsessed with Die Hard. But who is it? Rachel starts dating a guy who is played by Bruce Willis. And at no point do they ever go, hey, that guy looks like the guy from Die Hard.
Mm.
But aren't they obsessed with him, though? Don't they think isn't there a part where they think he's like super cool, kind of like.
The girls all think he's incredibly hot.
Oh, okay.
He's the father of Ross's daughter. Right. Yeah, Ross dates his daughter.
That's funny.
Gabe, isn't your favorite movie of all time Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion?
That's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
That's a good time. It's not my favorite.
That's a cool
intro. You guys hear that sound? It's the sound of viewers exiting out of our podcast.
Wondering what the hell has happened to this week's episode.
Sean, we're doing it for the SEO. The transcripts will get us the results.
There you go. Yeah. Hello, everyone. Michelle. Thank you for watching us on YouTube. If you are, please hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, recommend the show to a friend. The rest of you are probably listening in your cars, on your way to work, on all the different places you get your audio needs met. And don't forget, please, guys, come on, Real Blend Premium. It gets you an ad-free version of the show. It gets you a newsletter from me every other Friday. Check the description for information on where you can sign up. You guys need to watch the YouTube version this week specifically for Josh Cooley's interview. Josh Cooley did it from his home office. He's a director of Transformers 1. He also directed Toy Story 4. So he came up to the Pixar ranks and has leapt over to Paramount. And has a tiki bar themed home office. Gabe got a chance to see it. It has the wheel of a pirate ship in it and a lot of other accoutrements. I did try to get him to sort of elaborate on some of the props. He talks a bit about a few of them, but mainly we talked about Transformers. Was that your prime
directive?
Yeah, it was my Optimus Prime. Thanks, Gabe. I appreciate that. No, we do get into the references to You Got the Touch, which is a very famous.
What did he say in regards to that question I told you to ask?
The first one that you asked me?
Yeah.
He said it's in the process.
Yeah. Dude, I'm not kidding. This is going to make no sense to anyone who has no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, not yet. They're going to hear it in a second.
It's really big.
Yeah. Well, he said he had to get permission from his wife to bring it home.
That's what he told me to.
Yeah. Oh, did he really? Yeah. Okay. So anyway, to find out what we're talking about, listen to the first answer in the Josh Cooley interview. This is Josh Cooley, director of Transformers 1, coming on Real Blend to discuss his new film that's coming to theaters currently as we speak. Jake Hamilton, you got a chance to speak to. He's with Fox in Chicago. He was at the junket last week, and he said he wanted me to pass along that there were these massive life-size Transformers that were with you on set, and you'd promised him you were going to take one of them home. He wanted me to follow up and see if you were able to.
Yeah, it's in process.
What are some of the really cool keepsakes that you get from this journey? What are some cool Transformers swag that you now have?
Well, those statues, if you've seen them, they're like 7 feet tall, and they're massive, and so... I told my wife, I was like, because I know that they made like marketing made like 40 plus sets of them all over the world. And so I told my wife, those are pretty cool in our living room. And she's like, we'll see about that.
Yeah. See, so it looks like, is that an office that you have there?
Yeah, this is my home office.
Yeah. And so I basically get this room behind me to keep all my stuff in. My wife says nowhere else in the house.
Yeah.
So is it a similar situation for you?
Yeah, but at the same time, she knew what she was getting into when she married me. So, there's stuff. We've got toys all over.
Good. All right. Well, so just to give our audience a frame of reference, Josh, how long have you been working on this movie?
I started this movie in 2020. Yeah, right before the pandemic. Yeah,
2020. Okay. And I mean, is that the normal time of work on an animated film like this?
Yeah, I'd say about 3 to 4 years is probably about average.
Okay. Cybertron fans are going to get a chance to see is such an incredible location. I think longtime fans are going to want to spend so much time combing the background just to sort of see the amount of detail that you guys put in. But the one thing that really caught me off guard early on is the scale. Live action Transformers movies spend so much time trying to make the Autobots and the Decepticons look larger than life, you know, compared to human frame. And initially, you know, Orion Pax looks small in the grand scheme of it. I'm wondering if that was at least by design initially that you wanted to make him seem human size in this world.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the thing about the live action ones is that they're always kind of a fish out of water story where the robots are coming to our planet. And we're always looking up at them and, you know, they're 20, 25 feet tall. So, but in the live action films, you always have the human scale. You always have a frame of reference for us. You know, we know the size of a vehicle. We know that, you know, the camera is usually at the human height of looking up at the characters. And so knowing that this movie would be on Cybertron where we have zero people, it was important to establish that scale. And I knew I wanted to go the opposite direction from everything being, kind of from a human point of view, and to be from the robot's point of view, but that let the world be massive. Mm-hmm. Since scale is definitely in the DNA of Transformers. So knowing that we'd have Orion Pax and D16 kind of be underdogs and be the smaller Transformers at the beginning of the film, that was our human scale, was them. And everything else was massive around them. So a lot of the shots are showing how small they are in comparison to everybody else at the beginning. And then once they start to bulk up and transform, then we start to lower the camera and really make them feel like they're massive.
When you bring people up to the surface, it's such a visual explosion, essentially. What's an area of Cybertron that you just really loved being able to explore deeper?
That first shots of when they're up top there, I wanted it to be as kind of awe-inspiring to the characters and the audience. So it's kind of, you understand kind of their frame of mind. We've been underground for the first, 15 minutes of the movie. And so that was really cool to do because we looked at, I didn't want the planet to just be a big metal ball, like a big silver ball in the sky.
Yeah.
So we looked at metals that we have here on Earth, and there are some really stunning, colorful metals that naturally exist. And so we use that as reference and, should talk with ILM about that and how we can use some, like onyx kind of stuff and really reflective material that's really stunning and beautiful and kind of create our own, magic hour with that.
Josh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Okay, so this is a nerdy podcast. Like this is directors come on here and they just get into the details because I'm a little embarrassed to admit how long I spent staring at the reflections in the Transformers later on. Like initially they start with this amazing brushed nickel kind of approach to them, kind of scuffed up a bit. Mm-hmm. And then as they evolve, they have this amazing, gorgeous, reflective quality to them that captures light, and is showing, like it seemed, other characters reflected in them. Can you just talk a bit about how much work has to go into paying attention to what is being reflected off the metals of these characters?
Yeah. Just backing up, one of the things just to remind people with a CG animated film is there's nothing is for free. Like we have to design everything. It's not like, if you have live action, you show up someplace, any place with a camera, and you've got the environment there, you've got the light, you've got all that kind of for free. But in CG, nothing exists. And so everything is design. And when we designed the Orion Pax and D-16 from at the beginning of the movie, they're miners. They've been in the caves forever mining energon. So there's, if you look really closely, they've got scuffs and scratches and marks, and all the miners have that kind of built into their texture, and that's all hand painted on there under the model.
Right.
And once they are able to transform, I really wanted that like new car, you know, like that fresh off the showroom floor kind of look and that sparkle to it. And so they were able to have like full, you know, just you could see everything. And that was one of the challenges too, is like now that they're so perfect, is that the entire environment around them naturally, you know, reflects off of them.
Yeah.
And so that's something that, because it's in the computer, we can direct all that. And so I can go, hey, can you actually turn down the chest? It's a little bright right now. You know, okay. It's pulling my eye away from where it needs to be. So, and then it gets down. One of the things I didn't expect was just reflections and, you know, just the glare, or, you know, the sun glares, or the bokehs, you know, coming off of the reflections, just hitting the lens okay. flares. That's what I'm looking for. And how sometimes they would, you know, be blocking the character's face. So I'd ask, can we please move, you know, kill these glares over here, and or these flares, and they'd be like, yeah. So it's crazy the amount of stuff that we'd have to kind of go back in and adjust, because the natural light would actually kind of block the camera.
Okay, so this sounds unusual, I think, but like in live action, the Transformers themselves are visual effects, right? So yeah. All of that stuff is kind of being built. How different is it to create the Transformer in visual effects in a live action setting versus just being able to straight animate the whole thing?
Well,
is it a similar process at all?
Well, yeah, it is a similar process. The animators that animated on this film at ILM, also a lot of them animated in the live action ones as well. So,
oh, cool.
They had that that familiarity, that you know, all the physics of the large characters and weight and everything. They were automatically, you know, knew exactly how to do it. The thing that's different is you've got a live action plate with, you know, and you've got a real shot in live action, and then you're adding an effect on top of that or into that shot. Mm-hmm. And with this film, everything is built by ILM, which allows us to exaggerate things and to stylize it a lot more. We didn't have to match the live action.
Gotcha. There's very few things that are as instantly nostalgic as the sound of a Transformer transforming. And I just want to know, like, sorry, this is basic, but like, how do you make the sound? Does it exist on a computer someplace? Did you get to recreate it?
We basically recreated it. I don't know the exact, there is a machine that they used back in the 80s to create that sound. And right. Scott Gershon was our sound designer, and he knew exactly what it was. He knew the history of it and everything. And one of the things he did, which I thought was brilliant, was when our characters first transform, they don't fully make that exact sound.
Right.
It's
right.
Very, very close, but it's not that exact thing. We actually use it as a story point. So at the very end, when he fully turns into Optimus, I think the very last shot is when it's pure, that we know.
Yeah.
Everything before that is very, very close, but not quite, because he's not fully Optimus yet.
Oh, that's really cool. I love that. Yeah. Your thoughts had enough to make it a little bit off. That's really awesome. Jake also get a chance to speak with Chris Hemsworth at the junket, and was kind of blown away, you know, leaving it at how much he's able to transform his voice specifically. I gotta tell you, yeah. Coming out of our press screening this past Saturday, there was a nice lady who was like, you know what they should have had is the original voice actor deliver like one of the very last lines of it kind of thing. But that's Hemsworth. It is Hemsworth in the very end, isn't it?
Yeah. That was, in fact, I had thought of that same idea. You know, the big thing was, first of all, I grew up with Transformers. Peter Cullen is my Optimus Prime. He is Optimus Prime. Like, there's sure. no getting, there's that's, he's Optimus Prime. So that was when I signed on the dotted line for this movie. The first thing I freaked out about was like, oh crap, how are we going to do the voice? Because it's a younger version of Optimus. And so that actually helped me, because I was like, oh, it's Ryan Pax. It's not Optimus yet. And so that in my mind was a reason to go younger with it, to go a little more naive. Like he can't be all knowing. He can't be all powerful and knowledgeable and everything. So, and brave yet. So I talked with Chris a lot about that. And When we first talked, when we were first talking, I was like, okay, he's got the depth to his voice. He's got that heft to it. I totally believe. And he said he'd do an American accent, so that totally lined up. And as we were doing the recording session, one of the first recording sessions, he had the Orion Pax like down, like the kind of looseness to it, but real charm to it. And then at one point, we're getting towards the end of the movie. I saw him like even stand up a little straighter and kind of puff his chest out and start to go, you know, we've got to stand together, and like had that kind of cadence to it.
Okay.
And I was like, whoa, what are you doing right now? That's awesome. And he's like, yeah, I wanted to try you know, play around with what that could feel like to kind of transition. And it wasn't an imitation. It was just like nodding towards that direction, meaning he will eventually become, you know, that character.
That's incredible. But
that was a really fun way to do it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, so I got a chance to talk to Chris at Comic-Con this past year on the press line, and he started talking to me about asides, like doing asides. And what he said was, how come you can't use my previous ones? You know, like, I've done so many of these for so many action films. When you're a director sitting down with these guys, and do you not want to go to an archive and use some stuff that exists already?
Well, if it was the same studio, we probably could, but you know, that's all Marvel and Disney. There's no way, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
And also it's, and I know he, I totally get it. He's, you know, he's talking about the efforts and the, and all that stuff. And he's done it for everything, for every movie, of course, but sometimes you need him to be really, really specific. And so one of the things I did was I told him, I don't want to do that with you every session. What I'll do is we'll animate the action stuff, and then you put the cans on, and then you could follow the animation and just do it live, basically, to the animation. He's like, yeah, let's do that.
Nice. Did I catch a reference to the touch?
Oh, yeah.
There's at least one line of dialogue in there, right?
Yeah. Yes, there is. Alita says, you don't have the touch or the power. Do it right.
All right,
there has to be. It's the touch, you know. That's Stan Bush.
People who are our age, or at least sit up a little bit in their seats. What is the video game that the Transformers are playing in their locker room?
I believe it's called like Battle of the Primes, and the reason I remember that is because we used to have a scene where Orion Pax and D-16 were actually playing it side by side. Like you would come into the barracks and they were up close and you saw them playing. You got to get a nice big close up to the screen. It was basically Street Fighter, but with the Primes fighting each other. it was a real fun moment. It really kind of sealed their friendship. But at the end of the day, it was kind of like not fully necessary.
I had to ask you about it because you do come back around to it for a second joke later. Yeah. And I'll let people discover that one later on. So I wrote down the phrase, nothing bad happens when you stay on protocol. And I want to know if that's your creative mantra, or are you someone who likes to sort of break the rules and see where it takes you?
I totally believe in breaking the rules, but I think there are, you have to know the rules and then you break them to see, you know, to do something new and different. That's just kind of how I operate.
So what's something, what's a rule that you knew going into Transformers 1 that you can think of that you broke that made this a better movie?
Well, I mean, kind of the, you know, Optimus and Megatron being friends, like nobody thinks about that, you know, and I, that was something that I knew if we could sell that in Act One and really make like if the audience could really like seeing them together and want to see them together more, then it would make the end of the movie a heartbreak when and tragic when they fall apart. And so I think that's kind of the big, I wouldn't say it's a breaking the rule, but because it is part of the lore of them being at least having a connection together before they become enemies. But it was something that I was brand new to bring to this whole film, to franchise, actually.
What are some of the conversations that you had with Brian Tyree Henry in terms of making Megatron sympathetic to a certain extent because of the struggle that he's going through in this particular story?
Yeah, we had a lot of conversations about it. And I think it was the thing that made him want to do this movie was showing a side of this character that we understand and that we can kind of go, yeah, I get why he's acting that way. And it's, you know, not he'll go too far with it, but you understand how he's upset. And we had a version of the movie in story reels and storyboards where we went too far, actually, and the audience was kind of like, I agree with him. I agree with Megatron the whole time. Like, whoa, okay.
Got to pull this back.
We need to pull this back, yeah. And actually, it was actually making Orion's argument better. So, but yeah, that was one of the reasons I wanted to do this movie, too, is, you know, no villain thinks of themselves as the villain of their own story. And so if we can show a good reason for him to turn, it was going to make their relationship even sadder when they break up.
Josh, it was so heartening to go to the theater this past Saturday and see so many young kids, you know, in the theater, what I'm assuming is experiencing Transformers for one of the first times, you know. Did you think about this film being an introduction, you know, for a generation, getting to see them, these characters, for the very first time? How much did you think about the younger audience coming into it? And give me a sense of why you think that this franchise keeps having new life and coming back around.
You know, it's funny. I know that. So I've worked on a lot of movies that are like for everyone, that are family films. And so I never think about I never think in my head, oh, this is a kid's movie or this is a cartoon. I'm always trying to go like, what do I want to see? Because I know that there are also parents that are going to be watching this with their kids, and kids are way smarter than we give them credit, you know, for. They are just, they're right there the whole time. So where's it going with that? So, you know, I hadn't thought about kids specifically coming in for the first time, but I did think about just anybody coming in. Like when I first started on this film, I was thinking, what would my grandma understand this movie if she were to walk in off the street,
right,
and come into this movie for the first time, not knowing nothing about Transformers? Would she be able to understand it and enjoy it? And that was the goal. It was like, I want to try and get people who have not seen anything to come in and from the very beginning understand, and also hardcore fans to still enjoy it as well, which was a challenge, but it was something I think we hit it.
I've heard you talk about the fact that you have ideas for where the story could continue if you want to. Do you know if there's like a definitive end to the story that you would like to tell? Or is it you kind of just want to see where things go?
I don't have, you know, I didn't plot out exactly where the next thing would end. It was always just about this first film. This first film has to work in order to make anything after that work at all. So, you know, as we were finishing up this film, I couldn't help but think, oh, I could see how this could continue on, but it's not like a here's exactly how it would end kind of a thing.
Gotcha. And you have a great, great supporting cast as well, too. I just want to get your comments about who you were looking across in the sound booth and thinking like, I can't believe I'm getting a chance to interact with with this talent right now.
Yeah, the entire casting is incredible. It was really fun recording Steve Buscemi. Okay. You know, he's at Starscream and he's just a really, really sweet man, really awesome, really cool, and just down for anything. And, you know, I was like, okay, you're just going to scream your head off. He's like, okay, yeah, let's do it. You know, and he just goes into it. But I've seen him in everything in my entire, you know, life. So it was just really a trip.
And what about Ham?
Ham's amazing. Yeah, he went for it, and he totally got the character. He's actually, I didn't realize how much of a animation fan he is. Like, he loves animation. I'd show him tests and everything, he'd be like kind of freaking out, going, "That's so cool!" So it was really fun to share all that. But He's such a pro, you know, and he's one of those people where he knows his instrument really well. So I barely had to give him any direction in terms of, you know, speed or volume or anything like that.
So they always tend to say that they pull a film out of a director's hands, that you literally could keep working on it right up until it goes into theaters. But is that the case with animation? Has this been finished for a while? What do you remember is the last thing you worked on for this movie?
Well, the last thing that has been doing is like looking at the different versions, you know, IMAX and Dolby Vision and all that. But
Okay.
the last couple shot, well, the last shot of the movie was the last thing I finaled, actually.
Okay.
So
On purpose, did you keep it till the very end?
well, yeah, a little bit. I just wanted to make sure that it looked really good, you know,
Okay.
and what, you know, it's funny on an animated film, by the time you get to the end, that's when the animators know these characters, you know, inside and out. And so sometimes you want to wait until you want to schedule when they're going to be hitting those really important scenes, because that's when you know that they're going to be at the top of their game for the film. But yeah, the last shot is final.
All right, you say that, but when you did Toy Story 4, though, those characters are intimately familiar with the people who work there. What was the Do you remember the last shot you worked on for Toy Story 4?
It was definitely the goodbye scene, because I knew that was going to be. It waited on that, because even though they've, you know, done those characters before, there's still new characters that, you know, need to be touched, and it's just getting the, you know, basically getting them warmed up for the last shots of the game, you know, hit the three pointers.
That's really interesting. Okay, I gotta ask about the pirate wheel behind you. Is there a significance to the ship, the captain's ship wheel behind you?
So my entire office is like a tiki room. It's a tiki room office, and so
Okay.
got pieces of planes and fake animals all over the place. Yeah.
All right, final question, then I'll get you in here on this one. What are you working on next? I hate to push you
You
on to the next project, but do you have something brewing right now?
know, I got a couple things kind of in, you know, irons in the fire, but nothing to really to announce. I'm just trying to finish this one up, but
Vacation, I guess, right?
that would be nice. We'll see.
Awesome, Josh. Well, listen, I love this movie. I thought it was great. I know fans of all generations are going to love it. And I'm so excited for it to finally hit theaters so people can check it out.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a blast.
Thanks, brother. Good talking with you. I'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Thanks.
All right, bye now. And we are back. Thank you so much to our good friends at Paramount Pictures and also Josh Cooley for joining the show. You guys make sure to check out Transformers 1, of which we are going to review right now. And we're going to keep it spoiler free so that you can get our reaction to it. Jake and I got a chance to check it out at different times. This is a movie they have been promoting and teasing a lot because I think they know they have a pretty good movie on their hands. It was at San Diego Comic-Con. They did a long lead press day for it. I got to see it on Saturday, and I talked to Josh about this, about it, you know, just seeing it in a theater filled with families who are bringing their kids to hopefully, you know, get introduced to the Transformers mythology. And I mean it when I say it. Like, I really thought this should have been the approach to the very first Transformers movie. So to talk about Bay and what Michael Bay did, he brought the Transformers to Earth. This is animated. It's easier to do it this way, but it takes place on Cybertron. So you start essentially on the home planet of the Transformers. And what Josh Cooley talked about, which I find really interesting, is that it begins at a place where Optimus Prime and Megatron are not quite Optimus Prime and Megatron yet. They are, oh, now I'm going to blank on D16 is Megatron, and Prime's name is what? Jake, do you remember?
Nerd.
I did realize I was kind of nerdy. Gabe, help me out.
Let me, I'll
Optimus
see if
has a
they have
different
it
name.
on
They definitely do, but they're friends.
Orion Pax.
Orion Pax, yes, thank you very much.
Of course.
Yeah, no, never mind. I am a washed up nerd who knows stuff like that. But I liked their dynamic. I really liked the fact that at the start of this movie, these two are worker bee transformers who are essentially tasked with mining this energy substance that fuels the planet of Cybertron, and then something is going to happen that is going to pit the two of them against each other. And Jake, weigh in if you think this is interesting as well too. In a philosophically different, like, there is a clear cut conversation point to be had of whether Megatron is right to be upset of what he's upset about. Right. Like, I don't want to give it away, but it's not something as simple as, it's not a black and white thing. It's like, if you watch it and play out, and actually Josh talks about in the interview that they had cuts of the movie where it was a problem that the test screening audiences were siding with Megatron.
Oh,
and they had to pull back and almost like rework the order of the movie so that people weren't necessarily on his side.
Does that with like the final edits of Real Blend? He's like, wait a second.
They're unrecognizable.
The audiences are siding with Jake and Sean and Kevin. I must cut this episode to make sure they side with me.
I just re-record all my stuff. I Google it.
You mean, Jake, you don't listen to the episode and break down with notes? You don't hear the different edits that happen?
No, because I worry that if I hear your voice anymore, then I'm just going to fall in love with you even more than I already have.
All right, I'm sorry. Get the Transformers one. How did you feel about it?
I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was an absolute blast. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I'm still like a stone cold advocate supporter of Michael Bay's first movie. And I think the third movie in his series has some stone cold awesome action scenes. And that is not just because it takes place in Chicago. I saw it long before I ever moved to Chicago. But
which one's the third one? Dark Side of the Moon?
Dark Side of the Moon. Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. The last like hour and a half of that movie is just, it's all filmed in Chicago. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah,
but this movie, I feel like it had just a really great sense of humor. I thought the action sequences were really fun and immersive. I would still put it through like under the umbrella of like, it's an animated movie made with kids in mind. More so than I think obviously the Michael Bay films were. So I really had to sort of watch it through that perspective. That being said, I thought it was an absolute blast. Like I said, I've had these very nostalgic flashbacks to watching the old 80s cartoon, you know, sitting in front of, you know, laying on the ground in front of my TV, you know, sitting way too close to it. And so but like, through the prism of like it's an animated movie for kids. And that feels dismissive or diminishing. And I don't mean for it to be.
But you know what it's not, though? It's not like slapsticky, right?
No,
like
it's not. It's
goofy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have like adolescent humor at all in it. It's
there's more adolescent humor in some of Bay's films than there are, you know, particularly Revenge of the Fallen, than there are in this one. Like this one, in the same way that the 80s animated movie did, this one doesn't. It feels weird to say, oh, it treats kids like adults, but like it like a lot of great 80s kids movies did, it acknowledged that like kids can handle shit. Like, you know, it throws some heavy stuff out there. And
especially kids today.
Yeah. Yeah. Kids so, I really thought the vocal performances, particularly by Chris Hemsworth and Brian Tyree Henry, were phenomenal. You know, they do a really good job. You know, it's hard to, you know, when especially like stepping in the shoes of someone like a Peter Cullen, you know, that's tough, because then you're either going against what Optimus Prime should sound like, or you're just doing a Peter Cullen impression.
Sure.
Yeah. But I really thought that their dynamic was great, and it left me in a place where I sort of went, yeah, I'd go see another one. I'd go see another one. Even I saw this one for the junket, but I'd go see another one. Even if I wasn't doing the junket, I'd go just to see what happens next in that story. Well,
it's funny that you say that, because before our screening, we got a trailer for Sonic the Hedgehog 3.
Yeah.
I've not seen any of the Sonic movies at this point.
Sure.
But I cannot believe that we're up to a third one. Dude, are they making these really fast, or is it just me? Am I not paying attention? Kev, you're muted.
You haven't seen the first two Sonic films?
I have not seen
them. The first one was before the pandemic, right before the pandemic.
2019. Okay. And then the second one was like during the pandemic. I actually really like those movies.
Do you really? I mean,
I think Jim Carrey is incredible. I just think those movies really work. They're fun. It's some of the best video game adaptation I've seen. I mean, especially the first one. The first one is really good.
I had a bigger connection to Sonic, because like I watch them. I will admit I've never seen the second one, but I watched the first one and I realize that like they're very well made, like love letters to that game. But I didn't really play Sonic a lot growing up as a kid. So it just made it. I feel like it's a missed opportunity, because it's like, damn, if I played that in the same way that like I actually really loved Super Mario Brothers.
Maybe I'm clueless. I thought Sonic just ran and collected rings.
I was going to say the game wise, like especially the early stuff, it's more Sonic's kind of an interesting like mascot character. Doesn't doesn't quite have the like Sega Mario cachet, but like has a really strong fan base. And I think there was like an animated series. I could be wrong.
Yeah, like all these characters that like everyone's getting excited that they're like adding. Yeah. I'm like, where the hell did that character come from?
Yeah, yeah. People love it.
And Sean, I'm kind of with you, Sean.
Sean, you are correct because the first one came out in 2020. So three movies in 4 years.
I thought it was like I thought we did that junket, Kevin. Like, didn't we do that junket like in February and then the pandemic happened?
I think that's
it was the January or February of 2019. Yeah. Was it 19 or 20?
2020.
Yeah, it was 20. Yeah.
And I'm going to point out Ben Schwartz, terrific guest on the Riverline podcast.
Fantastic.
And great Sonic.
He was one of our first, I don't think we have video for that. He was one of our earliest like pandemic guests when we were kind of, everyone was not quite in like work from home mode. Everyone was still super casual about it.
Yeah,
and he just like gave us a tour of his place. He's like, I've been sitting here playing video games and trying to write for like 3 weeks.
Yeah,
it was great.
And then he shows up again later too. So the cat's out of the bag. He's the surprise guest on a Phil Lord and Chris Miller episode as well.
That was great.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was fun.
Surprise! They had worked together.
One of my favorite
after party.
One of my favorite interviews that we did during that time of the pandemic was Dr. Sleep with Flanagan.
The
2.5 hour, whatever, how long it was, interview for about the director's cut of Dr. Sleep.
We're due for a Flanagan, too, here soon.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, so not to divert too far, but I do want to bring up quickly The Life of Chuck, which is the new Mike Flanagan, adapted from a Stephen King short story, played in Toronto, wins the Toronto Audience Award. And someone dropped a stat on Twitter that said there hasn't been a winner of the Toronto Audience Award that hasn't earned a Best Picture nomination in X amount
like
of years.
Four, I think it's like 14
amazing.
Years.
Oh, yeah, that's
been an incredible
amazing.
Long run. But this is the weird part. Life of Chuck doesn't even have a distributor yet. Like, it has no release date, no distributor.
I bet it's going to be Prime.
Netflix?
I figure it's going to be Prime because he just entered that deal with Amazon.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised, but I'm curious if there's just some shopping that's happening.
Yeah.
Like I feel like we would hear if there was like a
pretty Warner Brothers does a lot of King stuff.
Think that film has a theatrical audience?
I wonder if that's why we haven't heard anything is because they're waiting to see how it's playing. If it's going to be like a streamer or if it's like, we're going to do a full theatrical run.
And I think it's the sad thing about, the state. I mean, listen, I think that movies are still doing well. And I think that those the doom and gloom box office stories I have a problem with because like every business, there's ups and downs. But for a film like Life of Chuck, which I haven't seen, but for us to even say, OK, do you think that would do well in theaters or is it not going to bring in like IMAX audiences and things like that? I mean, like you want a film like that to do well. But in this era of streaming.
Sure.
I bet you those conversations are being had. Is this the film people will leave their homes for? I mean, again, Flanagan's incredible, and I bet you the movie's incredible too. I mean, this is nothing about the quality. I just wonder about a box office draw.
Does the win at Toronto guarantee that it at least gets a awards like 2 week run? Like we're gonna get like a 2 week.
They're still coming out with like they just announced that Clint Eastwood's movie is coming out and on November 1st. Like that, we don't even have a trailer for that. Like we didn't even know anything. I didn't even know it was like officially done. And all of a sudden they're like, yeah, hey, by the way, this is so like we're still very much. But I have a question, Kevin. I have a question for you. Do you think that the success of it ends with us, a movie that costs $25 million and has made over 300? What is it? Through over 300 worldwide is at least reminding studios that those mid tier adult dramas can still have the power to bring people out.
I think the only difference for me is that It Ends With Us was a worldwide phenomenon of a book. Life of Chuck, I don't know. I personally had not heard of it. I don't know how popular it is in Stephen King's.
No, it's not. It's an old short story.
I think that's the best way to market that Life of Chuck is to remind people that, like, you know, it's from the from Stephen King, author of Stand By Me and Shawshank Redemption.
But that's what scares me. Like, would Shawshank do good today?
I mean, it didn't do well then.
But that's what's kind of interesting is like if Shawshank Redemption, which is one of the greatest movies ever, came out today,
yeah,
it probably would not have a huge box office. And again, this is not a quality discussion. This is a discussion. But then you look at, okay, so Beetlejuice did $110 million its opening weekend. It's a 36-year project between the first and second. Top Gun, what are people seeing? I mean, generally, It Ends With Us had a worldwide phenomenon behind it. So that kind of made sense. But you're right, though. These dramas, these... Like you want them to do better, but like I just don't know that the market is like I don't know. It's these but premium. Also,
what like doing well is subjective to, for each of these movies. You know, like yeah. like Life of Chuck. If Life of Chuck does 50 million in the theaters, that's great.
Like
that's,
could it, doesn't could have it do to, that though? Is Hiddleston a draw?
No, no, not quite like that. I've also heard he's not in the movie a lot. Like strangely,
isn't he Chuck?
He is Chuck, but the way that the story is structured,
this is more on the lines of like drama. This is drama Stephen King.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Okay. But it's, well, you'll see.
But I think you market it. I think you market it on Flanagan and King more so than King the cast.
But Flanagan, see, we love Flanagan.
Yeah.
But do people really know who Mike Flanagan is? Like on general audience.
I think that's a really good question. Name wise, I don't know, but I think if you put a title card up that
Haunted Hill House had
all of his amazing
work. But the problem is that all of his work points to something that Life of Chuck is not.
Yeah,
right.
True. Because and then if also, you say from Stephen King and the director of Haunting of Hill House, what you're going to tell people is it's a scary movie.
But then look at the flip side of this coin. There's a this flip might side of this coin.
The conversations that they're having.
Look at Coppola. Right. Mm-hmm. So Megalopolis opens next week. We all know. I mean, we can all guess it's not going to do massive numbers. His name is arguably bigger than Flanagan's.
Oh, yeah.
Arguably. And Megalopolis. Coppola can't. Now, we could speak to that film later on when we get to it in terms of like our reviews. But from a box office perspective, I don't know if it's going to do well.
Is Coppola a bigger name in like.
He's a big name.
No, he's a big name in like the history of cinema.
Yeah.
Mm. But like
people know that
he's a big name to people who don't go to the movies anymore.
But yeah, what's the movie that they would point to for people under the age of 28, 25? That like, you're trying to get to go to a theater for anything.
They don't have one.
There versus, is. I mean, I'm just saying. I still think you point at The Godfather, but I don't think that makes anyone go say, "Oh, okay, well then that means I gotta." Yeah.
Versus everyone that's seen Flanagan's, you know, series and
whatnot. I mean, dude, if Spielberg over the last couple of years, like his last two movies, two of the best films in his filmography, I would argue Fablemans and West Side Story. Mm. If those and Spielberg is far more active today than Coppola is and has far more recognition to the younger moviegoer. If he can't get people out based on his name alone, then name alone isn't working for most directors outside of Nolan and Tarantino.
This goes back to the book thing you just asked about. It Ends With Us. What was the last Spielberg film that did well? Ready Player One. Why did that do well? It's a popular book and people read that book. It's not Spielberg's name. So I guess it's kind of where we're getting at here. Flanagan, as much as I love that guy, I don't think people are going to go to a theater for his name.
I agree with that. I mean,
but also
keep in mind, the last time Flanagan had a popular Stephen King book,
it didn't do Dr.
Sleep. It was literally the sequel to his most famous book, arguably.
But I would also argue that Dr. Sleep grew post-release.
Yeah.
I think it's a bigger fan base than the box office says.
Oh, yeah.
Outside of the box office conversation, this movie is an awards play. Again, back to the audience award at TIFF. And I just want to reread you the nominees for Best Picture last year. I mean, obviously, Oppenheimer won. It crossed $1 billion. It's a behemoth. Barbie, also a behemoth. But you can't tell me that Life of Chuck doesn't fall somewhere in the likes of American Fiction.
Yeah.
Or The Zone of Interest.
Yeah.
Or Anatomy of a Fall. Or
did those films do
well? Past Lives. I'm not even saying they did well, but they earned Best Picture nominations.
Right.
True. But all those films probably, unfortunately, and they're all great movies, didn't make a lot of money.
Let's take a moment to not talk about the potential downside of the box office and talk about the idea that Mike Flanagan might have an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Awesome. That's awesome.
This is a little inside baseball. There's at least one or two Stephen King movies that come out every year, right? Stephen King adaptations.
I'm going to watch one of them tonight.
King doesn't really do press for him. He just doesn't. It's just not his thing. Stephen King showed up to the red carpet and premiere of
insane.
If that's not like the ultimate compliment, that I mean, for Flanagan, the ultimate, you know, like fan, that's got to be so cool.
Does Stephen King have box office pull?
I think so.
Yes.
I think he does.
So. He's a household name.
Does he? Yeah. I think he does. No,
but do people go to the movies for his name now?
I think he's a franchise.
I think that if you have his name and then the buzz around it is it's amazing. That's, yeah. That gets
people. Because the thing is, you have to, unfortunately, just for sheer numbers, the name Stephen King has been attached to some of the greatest movies ever made and some of the worst movies ever made.
Sure, right? Sure.
And I think you just really have to drive home and remind people his work has yielded some of the greatest movies of all time.
This is
one of those. It did incredibly well.
Is he the most famous author of our lifetime?
Yes, by far. I think not even close.
It's a good question. I was talking to someone about this the other day. Someone like James Patterson, like these names that aren't as big to us, maybe. But Patterson is everywhere.
Maybe sheer numbers, Patterson might, you know, but like Patterson.
Isn't Patterson an author that like kind of just sells his name to like a pre-written story? He's padding the stats.
I gotta be honest with you. If you put $1 million in front of me and said name five Patterson novels, I bet you could stop a majority of people in the middle of Times Square and say name five because Stephen King movies. Stories.
I would bet that there's five Patterson books on every bookshelf you walk into. Oh, you know,
they're bringing Alex Cross back. There's going to be a TV series.
I forgot Alex Cross was a Patterson thing.
What about Sean O'Connell?
What about Sean O'Connell? I can name you
100% of the books that Sean O'Connell has written.
Yes. How many of them have you read?
All three.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much. All right. Yeah. That's a good time to throw it to break. Yeah. we'll be back on the other side with a review of a red hot title that needs to be on your radar. So stick around. And we are back. Okay. So if you're paying attention at all to the film festival circuit, you will be hearing about a film called The Substance. It is currently out in theaters. So you can go check it out if you would like to. It is a career resurgence for Demi Moore. It is the continuation of incredible work by Margaret Qualley, who is accepting some incredible work. She was in Kinds of Kindness. She was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, obviously, and appears in this film as well, too. Also, what looks to be, I've only seen the trailer. The boys have had a chance to see it. An offbeat performance by Dennis Quaid, I guess is the way to put it. I know nothing about it. I'm going to implore you guys to react to it without giving away what to expect, because I kind of know very little about it, and I'd like to remain that way, but react away. Kev, you're a big fan of this. You dropped some reactions in the text thread, so why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, when Jake and I have saw this, and there's a lot to say, and there's a lot of questions that we have. Jake, you're on mute.
There's a lot of late night Saturday messages exchanged between me and Kevin over the weekend.
Yeah, this movie is.
I think they all started with "What the fuck, man?"
Unlike anything I've ever seen before. So basically, the concept behind the film is Demi Moore's character is an actress who is essentially being kicked out of her work because she's getting older. Sure. And Dennis Quaid's character is like looking for the in his perspective, the new young generation to kind of bring more audience to the show that they're doing. Yeah. And Demi Moore is obviously still like stunning and gorgeous. But because of the themes in the film, her character is being pushed out and she's like basically being treated like she wasn't this incredible huge star that she was in the story of the movie. And she comes across this piece of paper when she goes to a doctor, right, Jake? And it says like, you should check out this thing called The Substance.
Right.
And Jake, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to go into too many spoilers, but basically you inject it into your body and
there are very specific rules that you have to follow. And it basically just says, listen, follow these rules. And for 7 days, you'll be yourself. And then for 7 days, you'll be the person who you wished you were. But right. you have to switch back. Those are the rules. You are going to love being this other person.
Okay.
But when the 7 days are done, you have to go back to you.
Okay.
And with any good rule, there are consequences for if they are broken.
Is it don't feed Demi after midnight?
That's a great sort of parallel kind of thing. So all I'll say is that it is a very much a body horror movie. And I just had such a blast watching it. You know, we don't really get, I feel like, a lot of body horror these days, like good mm-hmm. old fashioned body horror. And you know, and there's a giant difference between body horror and, you know, I hate the term, but like a torture porn or the sort of stuff or whatever it is, the ultra violence sure. that Terrifier is. Sure. Good old fashioned David Cronenberg 80s practical effects and makeup body horror.
Some of the best body horror to me is this. I think this is a big distinction between that and torture porn. Mm-hmm. Body horror is quite often the person doing something to themselves.
Sure.
For the wrong reason. And torture porn is something horrible being done to a person by someone sure. else, by someone sure. else. And that separation is really interesting to me, because if a protagonist in a movie is making bad decisions and then suffering as a result of it, then you can kind of ride along and being like, you did it yeah. yourself. But if they're in a really tough situation where they've been kidnapped, you know, or, you know, they're being held someplace, I have less interest in that. Like, I feel that manipulates me into feeling a certain way. So I'm intrigued by Substance for this.
So, Kevin, you know, one of the things, you know, talking about sort of the difference between, you know, the concept of body horror and torture porn is that gross or graphic as this movie got, it never felt gratuitous. Like, I never felt like I couldn't actually, you know, like I had to go, oh no, God. Like, I was kind of, it sounds like I was very much enjoying the grotesquery of the whole, the whole thing is done. And again, it's not like it's not tongue in cheek. It's not meant to be laughed at, but like, I had fun watching this movie as rough as it gets. It never got to a point where like I had to look away because I couldn't take what was, which happens with me sometimes with some of the more graphic, brutal Eli Roth kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was really kind of like, for me, Coralie Farja did a great job with the idea of like the practical effects, but also the use of sound design. And I'm sorry if I'm butchering her name.
Like the crunch, because you're exactly right with body horror. The visual is only 50% of it.
Yeah. And the sound design, the editing, the way the camera moves, the way they build the world, the way that the rules are done, as you were saying, with the different substance, it's really kind of well done. So I loved it. It's one of the best films I've seen this year for sure.
It's a great year for horror. You know, we were just talking about, you know, Strange Darling and this film, you know, there's Long Legs, obviously. I mean, the fact that I consider a good year for horror if one horror movie makes my top 10 list at the end of the year. And right now, I think I've got three different really strong contenders, wildly different films: Strange Darling, Long Legs, and The Substance, all three. And I don't, you know, I gotta be honest, I don't know which one I like better.
Romulus is on my list as well. Is Romulus horror?
Sean, top 10 best.
Yeah. Romulus. Amazing. Let me ask, I want to compare this to a film that you guys tried to sell me on, and it was a hard no, which is Titan. Is this Titan 2.0?
I was not a big Titan fan. I did not particularly like enjoy the process of watching that.
No, I bailed on Titan. Yeah,
I would say, like, do you like The Fly?
Yeah, definitely.
Then you're sold. You're in.
Okay, that's good.
I mean, is that a cheap comparison, Kevin? The Fly?
No, I think The Fly is a great comparison. And
this isn't a spoiler. Within the first 10 minutes of the movie, there's a up close and personal shot of a fly floating in a glass of wine. Was that meant to be a little like?
I think so for sure.
Let me ask you guys this way too early prediction in September. Any Oscar nominations you see coming out of this? Demi Moore?
Demi Moore and Margot Qualley are amazing in the film. I don't know if they'll get Oscar nominations.
Here's the problem is that you can't truly appreciate the arc of Demi Moore's performance unless you watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
And watching, I think there's particularly in the last hour of this movie, it goes in such a direction that I could see a majority of the older Oscar voters going, nope, and just clicking it off. And if you don't get the whole arc of everything, I mean, does Demi Moore deserve an Oscar nomination? Oscar nomination? Yes. Unfortunately, I feel like the movie itself will just be too much of a turnoff for
industry.
The industry
loves a comeback story, though. They love it.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, when you're in the last hour of this movie, you text me and you tell me how much of a comeback story they love.
What's the clip? Okay. Yeah, what's the clip, Jake?
All right, sounds good. There's a meme that's been pretty consistent that I've seen where it's a shot from Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, and it's Paul Rudd saying to a character, I need you to distract Kang, and people just keep dropping in random characters. Like, it'll be Paul Rudd, and he'll be saying on a subtitle, Poor Things, I need you to distract Kang, and it's Emma Stone as Poor Things. I saw one this morning, and it said, The Substance, I need you to distract Kang, and it's Demi Moore standing next to him, ready to run into action. And it makes me laugh every single time, so... I'm all in. I'm all in on The Substance and the eventual crossover at the MCU. Before we close out for the week, so highly recommend. You guys recommend The Substance. It's in theaters.
100%. Yes.
Okay, yeah. Good. I'm going to go out of my way to go see it this weekend. By the time you guys have listened to this on Thursday night, The Penguin is going to have its premiere. So the first episode will be available. This is going to be a weekly rollout, which is kind of fun. Thank you. There's some good things coming in this series. This is Colin Farrell reprising his role of Oz Cobb, not Oswald Cobblepot.
How do you feel about that?
I don't like it. I don't like it either. Nah, it's kind of dumb. Matt Reeves has said that he wanted to ground the character a little bit more, so he took away the name, but like, fucking name.
It's his name.
Yeah. It's like changing the name of Bruce Wayne. What are you doing? So anyway, you know, I've kind of been describing this show as The Sopranos in Gotham City. And I think
that's your name to Sean O'Connell Pot.
Yeah. Chester Copperpot. I'm not saying that the Penguin show is as good as The Sopranos. It doesn't reach to that level. But in terms of. So at the end of Matt Reeves's The Batman movie, John Turturro's character, Carmine Falcone, gets killed. He gets shot by the Riddler and eliminated. And he was largely the gangster that was pulling all the strings and manipulating all the crime bosses. And so now there is the traditional power vacuum. And who's going to fill in that space that's been left open by Carmine Falcone? And you have members of the Falcone family. You have members of the Maroni family, of which Clancy Brown ends up becoming one of them, playing Salvatore Maroni, and he's in prison. But primarily you have Sophia Falcone, played by Kristen Milioti, who people might know from How I Met Your Mother. Is that what she was in? She's in Palm Springs.
She's the mother.
She's the mother of How I Met. I never watched a single episode of How I Met Your Mother, but she's in Palm Springs with Andy Samberg. She's terrific.
Good for a while.
She is fucking great in this movie.
In
this show. I'm not even saying that like she steals it from Colin Farrell, because I think Colin Farrell is incredible in this show. But it's Milioti's show just as much as it is Oz's, because of the character arcs that they go through. Jake and I have been lucky enough to watch all of the different episodes. Kev, you got a chance to see the first one before you did the junket. Do you think it's going to be something that you're going to stick with?
100%. I'm very excited. I think the makeup effects that Mike Marino did are incredible. And I'm looking forward to it. I've only watched the first episode, but I'm going to watch it week to week for sure.
You know what you are not prepared for? Where this show starts and where it ends.
Yeah.
It is stunning the amount of stuff that happens over the course of the 8 episodes. So highly recommend sticking with it. It's really, really great. And it does. Jake, I wonder how you feel about this. We are seeing several examples of television shows that are trying to expand out on existing universes, whether it be the Marvel side or the Star Wars side. This, I thought, was a perfect counterpart to where the Batman left off, of just being able to be like, so without getting into too many spoilers, the show does very early address the flood that was created at the end of the Batman, and the impact that the flood has. And it just naturally continues the conversation of, all right, well, how is Gotham going to react to this? And that colors a lot of the early story. It's going to also feed into a few things that happen later on in the series. I cannot recommend this enough. I think that this is a tremendous, tremendous series. And if they were to tell me that we're doing another episode of these, another 8 episodes, but it's going to focus on another member of the Batman Rogues Gallery, I'm all in. Like, I think that that's fantastic. I want to see them continue to sort of explore that world through someone else's eyes.
I also love the show, but I want to throw two things out there, as devil's advocate, to sort of get your thoughts on, at least.
Okay.
I don't think it's a secret, because I asked about it at the junket, and the reason I asked about it is because it had already been out there. We never see Batman in the show.
Right.
That being said, what I found interesting isn't that we don't see him, because that's fine. I get it. It's Penguin's show. But he's never even talked about, the Riddler is casually brought up in conversation. The Batman characters are brought up. The events of the final act of the Batman are very much a major part. The flooding of Gotham City. Mm-hmm. But like, the Penguin was chased through the streets of Gotham City by a guy dressed as a bat. And at no point in the days following that does he ever say anything to anyone about, like, hey, like, as he's trying to climb the ranks of the crime lords in Gotham City, does he ever say, like, hey, we have this other guy we're going to have to deal with, too?
It's my only knock on the show.
Like, I get it. You don't have to show him, but you have to talk about him.
Having seen all episodes, there are too many moments when criminals are doing criminal things where someone had to say, hey, is the fucking Batman going to show up tonight? Like, we should be concerned.
Especially because when the Batman starts, it is already established that, like, he's like, you know, all those criminals are like doing things and like looking up to the sky. And like that, like, he's already struck fear into the heart of criminals in Gotham.
Right.
So the fact that there's this whole other gang culture of different, you know, families going after each other.
Well,
but none of them are afraid of Batman.
And there's a lot of bravado speeches about, like, we're taking this back from this family and we're rising up because we're the right family. And it's all it needed was a line of also, like, and that bat character better be looking out for us too, you know, like, and I would be like, ah, okay, good. At least they're aware that he's out there. So Matt Reeves kind of said to me that, like, in the first movie, they made it somewhat clear that to Batman, Oz was a bit of a joke and he didn't feel the need to pay that close attention to him. But I'm like you in that I would have loved just a line or two sprinkled throughout a couple of the episodes that was just like, hey, you know, something else, Batman. Yes.
Point two. Because I know we got to go. It is, in terms of language, in terms of violence, a very R-rated show. Every character drops an F-bomb every 30 seconds, which is great.
Yeah.
How are they going to explain that all of the people of Gotham have cleaned up their language by the time we come back around to the Batman Part 2?
Batman Part 2, R-rated. Let's do it.
I mean, that'd be great, but I just think it's weird that, like the Penguin drops no F-bombs in the Batman. It's F-bomb, 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 F-bomb over the course of the Penguin, and then all of a sudden he's going to go back to not swearing.
I mean, if James Gunn is going to have his own Batman, and, you know, R-rated superhero movies are crushing it, why not just, let's let it fly.
Deadpool. What's going to happen in Deadpool, too? Deadpool can't say all the words he says in the other MCU films that he enters into, like if they're PG-13.
He's going to push the envelope, though.
Yeah, but it won't be like, you know, it'll be similar.
It'll be, but, you know, he'll make a great joke where, like, he'll censor himself and be like, oh, that's why I'm in a different movie. Like, he'll, you know, he'll say something like that.
Right.
I don't know. We shall see. So the call to action this week, down in the comments down below, here's how we want to hear from you guys. Now that you're starting to check out the Penguin and you've seen at least the first episode, and I'm saying to you guys, and Jake is saying this as well too,
yeah,
stick with the series.
Yeah. We've seen all eight, and the finale is arguably the best episode.
And it gets dark.
That episode four is pretty great.
Episode four is really great as well too. Yeah. Who would be a classic Batman rogues villain character that you also would like to see get an eight episode run that is parallel to the stories of the Batman? I mean, Catwoman is an option. We watched her sort of venture off into another city. You could get Zoe Kravitz into a series if you wanted to. You could use another season to potentially, I mean, the Batman Part 2 isn't coming out until October 2026.
Yeah, that's crazy, man.
It is currently October 2024. You know, like, you could have another series out in the 2025 if you wanted to ramp it up. And it could introduce the villain of Batman Part 2 and even bridge the gap even more. So
I would, the Penguin in, or not the Penguin, the Riddler in, it's just surviving in Arkham.
Yeah,
could over do that. Episodes. And like, Paul Dano? Becoming... best friends with Barry Keoghan's Joker.
Could do that. Yep, I would watch that. So let us know in the comments what you would like to see happen. We will continue to track the progress of the Penguin, and we have plenty more exciting movies opening in theaters in the coming weeks. We've got a lot of efforts out there for good interviews for Real Blend. We appreciate you guys showing support to the show, following us every single week, tuning in, listening. Thanks, guys, for checking out the James McAvoy and James Watkins interview. That did some pretty good numbers. A lot of good comments about McAvoy and See No Evil that people got a chance to check out over the weekend. In the meantime, we'll be back next week with brand new episodes. So follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. And the show, as always, is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week.
That is always. We were, I don't know if you know this, we were once an award show.
And until then.
Dunkirk.
The Godfather.
Night, bitch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.